This is Fresh Air. I'm Margo Adler. Eddie Izzard has been called the queen of comedy, the coolest straight man alive in high heels, frosted hair, and drop-dead red lipstick. But as Ron Wertheimer wrote in the New York Times, the first thing you notice after you notice that he's wearing high heels is how smart he is. His interests range from ancient history to society's latest offenses, and his mind leaps from one thing to another in an extreme of consciousness monologue. Eddie Izzard has appeared in the movies Shadow of a Vampire, The Velvet Goldmine, and Mystery Men. In the new Peter Bogdanovich film, The Cat's Meow, set in the world of 1920s showbiz celebrities, gossip columnists, and writers, Izzard plays Charlie Chaplin.
Don't tell me Eleanor Glynn has arrived on time. Good God, perhaps even early.
Oh, all right then. Hello, you little bastard.
It's the little I object to.
I see your young passion flame is not accompanying you.
Lita, is she not here? I seem to have forgotten her. Let's keep it that way, shall we?
Izzard is one of England's stars of stand-up comedy, but through films and comedy, he's also become popular in the U.S. His one-man show, Dressed to Kill, had a successful run in the States in 1998 and was later adapted into an HBO special. Terry Gross spoke with Izzard 2 years ago. They started with an excerpt of the special.
The Founding Fathers in 16... They set off from Plymouth and landed in Plymouth. How lucky is that, eh?
Get there and go.
This is Plymouth. This is Plymouth. We set off from Plymouth. Come. We've gone round in a circle, lads. Back on the boats. Come on. This is Plymouth, too. My God, there's two Plymouths. Back on the boats. Eventually, they get to America and go, ah, this is the place that God has brought us to. We can raise a family here. We can practice our religion. There's nobody here. Excuse me. There's nobody here. No human soul on this land. Who are these people over there with a big... What's that feather stuff on their heads doing? Could you... What? No, we weren't expecting you. Our God has brought us here, and... No, we don't want any of your food, thank you very much. Just put some clothes on, for God's sake. Have you no shame? Meanwhile, that winter... Excuse me, do you have any food? I love all this stuff on your head. It's a fantastic idea, really. Very adaptable, aren't they, the immigrants? Yes, yes. Lovely. Got your own religion? Fantastic. We got one too. Thanks. Hello. Lovely. Yes, we were trying to grow bananas. Didn't really work, but thanks. Thanks for the food, anyway. Yes, there's more of us coming, but we all keep our promises.
Now, I think your early comedy performances were as a street performer in England. And from what I've read, it sounds like in your early act, you rode a unicycle, you did sword fighting in the street, worked with trick handcuffs. Were you planning on joining a circus?
No, it's the problem with the street is you cannot do, you have to do physical situation comedy. Being really analytical, which I gained from coming out as being a transvestite and having to self-analyze myself, I gained this gift of intensive analysis. So I analyzed the street because I went down. I thought, I'll get the street in 2 weeks and then I'll be doing shows. People can give me some money. I can earn a bit of money this way. But it took me a year. And people will not respond to spoken word. If you go out and do stand-up, unless you had a huge amplifier behind you, you cannot do sketches. You can't do sketches or spoken word because there's not enough glue out there. There's not enough... The audience won't stick around for that. They need to see something physical, situation in front of you. So that's why juggling and magic and stuff works. Visual things. Visual things really kill out on the street. But the spoken word, it just gets lost and people can't quite hear. And then there's no sense of atmosphere. And there's too much other noise going on of wind and rain and cars and people and other people laughing. And so you couldn't do stand-up out there. You had to do stuff that was sword fighting or these... really weird tricks and fake knife throwing used to do, or getting on a big unicycle and getting out of a pair of handcuffs. That ended up as my big stupid show. I wasn't really into the show, but I could talk a lot of inane, strange comedy in between it, and I could lace it in between the show. And they would stay because I was on a unicycle and I might die, basically.
It was like
a car crash thing. They were thinking, this is a car crash waiting to happen. Maybe he'll die. You know, even on a tough day when it's raining and snowing, I'd still sort of hang around in case I died. I thought that was my essential glue. It's a sort of, will he die? Oh, he hasn't died. All right, well, let's give him 5 pence. So So that was the show I ended up with. But what I really liked on the street, what I really learned was how to start a show. And in starting a show, you have to build it up from nothing. And so there's about 20 minutes which it takes to build up enough of an audience so that you can actually start. Because if you start with too small an audience, you never actually build further from that. It's quite complicated.
So how would you start the audience?
Well, it was quite often it'd be just getting... Well, I'd put down tea cozies. I had these tea cozies that looked like animals. They were a duck tea cozy and a... you call them tea cozies that you put over...
The little quilted thing you put over a teapot to keep it warm.
Yeah, that's it. And... there was a duck and a penguin and a hippopotamus, and I just bought these. And I used to put them on the ground very slowly. And I discovered this thing. Well, I didn't discover. I noticed other people doing it on the street, that if you put something very slowly down with a lot of focus on the street, people will watch you doing it. It will draw their attention because they think, well, what are you doing? If you just have a lot of focus and you put it just very gently down the street. So I was doing this, and I'd take about 20 minutes to put these out. And people would just sort of form around thinking, well, he's going to do something with these tea cozies. And then I'd never do anything with them. So I just managed to build up an audience that way. Or I'd talk to people, and I'd sort of... In the end, I was actually just standing on the street and just spieling to people. I could just go on and on and on and build up scenarios. And people would just walk across in front of me, sort of ignoring the show while I was trying to build a show. And I'd say, this is Janine and this is Sarah. They're dressed up at the moment as they're playing characters. I've employed them to do this. As you can see them walking through, they'll ignore me. They'll ignore me because they're very good. They're always in their characters. They never sort of come out of character. So I'd impose this scenario. These are just two women walking across, and I would impose the idea that they were actors portraying two women who happen to be walking across. And then I'd say they would change. In 5 minutes, they'll come back as different characters. Then I'd pick two other people and say, that's them. That's them now. And everyone knew it was rubbish, but it was quite neat because it sort of worked. And I could do this imposing scenarios thing and sort of get a certain atmosphere going as if I was controlling things, as if I... You have to use what's going on and look as if you're the master of ceremonies in this show. But in fact, it was just stuff happening around you.
Eddie Izzard talking with Terry Gross about his work in comedy and films. We'll have more of this conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to Terry's interview with Eddie Izzard. He currently plays Charlie Chaplin in the new Peter Bogdanovich movie, The Cat's Meow.
Your mother died when you were six, and after that you were sent to boarding school.
Yeah.
Whenever I see a movie that's set in a British boarding school, there's always an element of sadism in it, where the older boys pick on the younger boys, and it seems like it was a pretty... pretty uncomfortable place to be for a lot of people. How was it for you?
It's the classic one of the Tom Brown school days, which has this thing called fagging, which is, basically people work as servants for the older boys, and they can beat the hell out of you. And that's, I think the amount of bullying or whatever that went on was typical for any school. It didn't, you know, there was some that went on, but it wasn't overtly in that sort of stuff you've seen in films. The first school I went to, I really didn't like. I just didn't like, well, it was, I was six, so I just, it wasn't a great place to go. And it was a bit like being on a desert island. But the second and the third, the second school I went to had a more healthy place, which I, first one was in Wales, South Wales, and the second one was in the south of England. And that one had a much more, the headmaster there was a decent guy, and it was a generally positive place. There was a certain amount of bullying that went on, but, you know, that was just what happens in schools. And then by the time I got to the third school, which is kind of probably harder to deal with, I was already like a rock and emotionally. Like, you know, I wouldn't cry. No one was going to sort of give me a hard time because I was going to give them a hard time first. So I was already built to resist any problems that would come up.
When you were in boarding school, were you able to use humor in self-defense?
Yeah, it was absolutely. It was to get popular at school and get popular with girls and just to get popular, basically, to get more popular. Well, because I used to, when I was up to 13, I used to play football, and I lived for football, and that was my kind of, that was which you call soccer. But that was the thing I love, and this is why I'm a male tomboy. This is football and makeup. I was in the first team, and, you know, and it was school matches, and that's what I lived for. Then I went to the next school. They didn't play football. So, and I wasn't very good at the other sports, so I just, I lost a center of where I was going. And even though I liked acting and stuff, I hadn't had any parts up to this point. So I started pushing slightly more on this acting stuff, And then I started developing that I could do this comedy in the classroom and be witty and do those thrown lines, those lines that you throw at the teacher when they're in between a comment, you can just drop a line in that really works and cracks the class up. And that was working well. And then there were no girls at school until the sixth form, so I was about 17. And then a few girls turn up in this. It was bizarre. So you have one girl for 20 boys. So it just didn't. I didn't talk to any girls for a long time because I wasn't playing sports. I wasn't head of the school. I wasn't. I was just some guy wandering around with greasy hair and acne, basically. But the comedy got me out of that comedy because I found that I could use that in the class, and it just it was a social tool, really.
So when was the first time you actually acted on the impulse to wear makeup or dresses?
Well, it got a bit weird because my mum died, and so I and there was no sisters in the family, so I had no access to anything until... Well, there was bits of... there was occasional stuff at school, but really I got to college, and then when I got to college, I was doing theatre shows, and there was a whole wardrobe department there. So I thought, hey, you know, I'm running this show. I can go in this wardrobe department and just say, oh, let's borrow this for the moment.
Did anyone ever walk in on you before you were out and you had to, like, make up an explanation about why you were wearing a dress?
No, that didn't happen. I once got some kids sort of chasing after me saying, why are you wearing a dress? Why are you wearing makeup? So they were I was trying to go home, and they were trying to follow me. So I thought, I can't go home now because they'll know where I live. So I thought, I sort of wandering off in a different direction, and they kept chasing after me until I thought, right, I'm going to talk to them. So I stopped and said, look, you want to know? You want to talk to me? Come and talk to me. And then they just ran off. So that taught me something. I thought, oh yeah, they're actually, everyone's just scared of their own shadow. But that's that kind of bullying thing, because they were pushing, and so I turned around and said, okay, what do you want to talk about? And then they ran. And I find this with little, small, young children, girls and boys. If I'm wearing makeup, they'll come to me and say, you're a girl. This thing which, for a boy, when you're at school, is supposed to be the big thing you can't be.
Oh, there's the biggest insult.
Yes, and that's the one that's undefendable. You can't, and you have to say, no, I'm not. And they go, yes, you are. You're a girl. And when I'm wearing makeup now, and little kids will come to me, you're a girl. And I go, yeah. And then they stop and they think, hang on, that's supposed to work. And they say, no, you're a girl. I go, yeah, I am. And then you can just see the confusion on their faces. And it's almost like they're getting into a group huddle and saying, look, surely we should say he's a girl. He should say no. And then we've got him. But if you're saying yes, that's denying the whole, we've got no argument to go to. And they could just see that they can't deal with it. They have to wander off shaking their heads.
Did you ever have to tell a girlfriend who didn't know that you were a transvestite that you were, and then she had a... react to the fact that you see yourself as a male lesbian, which might have been confusing to her?
Yes, I think it is slightly more difficult in relationships. But the main, because women think, well, how does that reflect on me? What do you think of me, or what will other people think that of me if I'm going out with someone who's transvestite? And it gets a little bit confusing for a woman in that area. But generally, I thought most women would just say, well, that's it, I don't want to talk to you. But in fact, a lot of women are very positive and supportive and curious about it, being out about it, being TV. So, it's a lot different to what I thought it would be like. A lot better, a lot more positive, way more positive. If I had my life over again, I said I would be TV. Like, it seemed like it would be so much simpler, seeing as I fancy women, just to be straight, you know. But it's actually taught me so much, and it's so much of a quest thing. You've learned so much. You gain so much in confidence and understanding how human nature works by being TV and having to come out, or being gay or being lesbian, the whole coming out thing, that I just found it really positive.
Let me ask you a shopping question. There's a lot of, like, hip boutiques or something, and I'll walk into, and people just kind of look at me funny because I maybe, like, don't look quite, like, hip enough to qualify to shop there. Or maybe it's because I'm, like, short and they know nothing in their store is going to fit me. But, you know, I do get some strange looks. Like, I'm not really a member of the club, you know, that really hip clothes club, and they know it. What kind of looks do you get when you go shopping?
I have trained myself not to take in looks.
Mm-hmm.
I trained myself to think Elizabeth Taylor, and I remember hearing about. I thought that would come in handy. This is Elizabeth Taylor, about, you know, about in the '50s or sixties. I read about her turning up. Richard Burton was filming, and she turned up. He was filming in Italy, so she turns up in Italy, gets the chief of police to take her out to the set. So with screaming motorbikes and sirens and everything, she turns up and gets out in some sort of coat, out of a Rolls Royce and out of police cars. And you just thought, well, yeah, that's a way to do an entrance. And I found, like, trying on clothes in shops, if I go up and I say, I'm a bloke, I'm going to try on this skirt. If I say, can I try on this skirt? And I think most... I found that most people in shops go, well, I don't think that's possible at all. We'd have to kill you first. Surely that's illegal in several states and hangable. Can we hang them for that? But I found that if I say, I'm trying this on in there, I'm going now, then they go, ah, fine, right, okay. Because I'm just trying it on in a cubicle. I just want to buy their clothes. They want to sell their clothes. So it's a confidence thing. And I found that if I asked, then I would get rejected. But if I said, I am doing it, they go, fine, you do it. And that's an interesting attitude, and I have to be just really upfront and very knowledgeable. Like, quite often you get these people who go, can I help you? Very quickly, especially if men go up to makeup counters. And I have to say, yes, I want these lipsticks are no good. I don't like those. Those are kind of mushy, right? And I have to be very knowledgeable in my area of makeup just so that they pull back a bit and don't get in my face. Well, these are very nice. Who is it for? So, it's for me, and I want this, that. Don't want that. That's rubbish. That's way overpriced. And you may as well burn that lot because it's useless. And I kind of get kind of aggressive in that way so that they just back out of my face.
Would this work for me, do you think?
Yeah, I think you have to assume you have to think Elizabeth Taylor. You have to think, or a person that's going to work for you. You have to just come in and be very disdainful. If you feel you're getting disdain towards you, double the disdain back. And if they say, can I help you? You say, I'm sure you can't.
You see, this is how being a theater person can really come in handy.
Yes, well, exactly.
Because I'm not good at that kind of stuff. I mean, I'm not good at, like, thinking Elizabeth Taylor. I can't really pull that off.
I think you can if you practice. Elizabeth Taylor might not work for you, but it worked for me. You've got to think someone who you think, right, I'm going to think that person. And just try to stay, just be... Think, okay, people are going to give me hassle, so I'm not going to assume it because you don't want to attack if someone's actually trying to be helpful
right,
or whatever.
Right.
But you just want to be up there and in that kind of high eyebrow kind of, yes, I don't know if your shop is really worthy of me. That's what you really need to think of. Listen to Walkman is a very good way of doing it. I found going into those shops when I first started earning a bit of money and I sort of go in there and there's one person in there and it's very quiet and everything, you pull out socks and they're sort of, you know, 100 quid,
right.
100 pounds and you go, gee, I can't even breathe on these socks. And so I found that I would just put on a Walkman and I'd be very kind of like, as if I'm a designer because that's what look you come into. You come into like you're a designer. You just say, I do this thing. This is my job. So just be very quick and pull out the stuff and throw it back. And oh, this is rubbish. And then just walk out. And if you adopt that attitude, they'll have to bow down to it because all they're doing is adopting an attitude of snottiness towards anyone who comes in. So you just got to crank your ego up, get on the raised eyebrow thing, and a Walkman can really work because you can just listen to music and they could be saying, "Can I help you?" And they can come right up to your face and you just ignore them. Because when people say, can I help you? I never look at them now. They say, can I help you? Because then you go, probably not, I don't know. You know, you just get into a lost thing. So when they say, can I help you? I just go, no, I don't think you can. And I just make sure that it's that one of the last things that's on my mind is talking to them. Because I just it takes me into a low status thing. And they must know what they're doing there.
Well, I appreciate all the advice.
It does work. You just have to practice it. If at first it doesn't work, just keep thinking, okay. Keep in the zone.
Well, Eddie Izzard, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks very much.
You know. And then I had to chat girls up, and I'd never had the ability. You know, I'd only tagged them before, and now I had to use verbal skills. Susan, you don't have the ability at 13 to be able to say, Susan, I saw you in the classroom. The sun came from behind the clouds, and a shaft of sunlight caught your hair, golden framing your face. Your eyes burned blue fire into my soul. I immediately read the words of Dostoevsky and Karl Marx. And in the words of Albert Schweitzer, I fancy you. But no. No, at 13, you're just going, hello, Sue. I saw you in the room. I've got legs, you know. Have you? Oh, yeah, there they are. Do you like bread? Look, I got a French stick. Yeah, French loaf. Boom. Bye. I love you.
That was a clip from Eddie Izzard's 1998 show, Dressed to Kill. He is currently playing Charlie Chaplin in the new Peter Bogdanovich movie, The Cat's Meow. This is Fresh Air.